This is Gnostic Media Research and Publishing's podcast, episode number 163. I'm your host, Jan Irvin. This episode is an interview with Dr. Colin Ross, part three, titled Conclusion on MKUltra and Mind Control, and is being released on Monday, April 22, 2013. This third part of this series with Colin was recorded on Tuesday, April 16, 2013. Dr. Ross is an internationally renowned clinician, researcher, author, and lecturer in the field of trauma-related disorders. He is the founder and president of the Colin A. Ross Institute for Psychological Trauma. Dr. Ross is the executive medical director of three trauma programs located at Timberlawn Mental Health Systems in Dallas, Texas, Forest View Hospital in Grand Rapids, Michigan, and Del Amo Hospital in Torrance, California. Dr. Ross provides treatment for patients with trauma-related disorders and symptoms. This would include treatment for post-traumatic stress disorder, PTSD, dissociative disorders, borderline personality disorder, addictive disorders, anxiety disorders, depression, and obsessive-compulsive disorder. The symptoms treated and the admission criteria are suicidal ideation, homicidal ideation, self-destructive and addictive behaviors, and inability to function. Dr. Ross has written extensively on the subject of dissociation and trauma. His latest books include Trauma Model Therapy, A Treatment Approach for Trauma, Dissociation and Complex Comorbidity. Other books by Dr. Ross include The Trauma Model, A Solution to the Problem of Comorbidity in Psychiatry, and Schizophrenia, Innovations in Diagnosis and Treatment. Dr. Ross's books are available through his website, rossinstitute.com, which is rossinst.com, and at amazon.com and at area bookstores. And of course, Dr. Ross has also written many books and papers on MKUltra and government mind control, including the CIA's doctors and many other books. And he's authored 170 professional papers and 27 books total. He has reviewed for numerous professional journals and is a member of the American Psychiatric Association and is a past president of the International Society of the Study of Trauma and Dissociation. And in addition, Dr. Ross has served as an expert witness in over 50 court cases, consulted on television, movie, and video productions on trauma-related disorders, and produced 6 educational videos and CDs for mental health professionals on the treatment of trauma-based disorders. You can reach Timberlawn Trauma Program at 1-800-426-4944, Forest View Trauma Program at 1-800-949-8439, and Del Amo Hospital at 800-533-5266. And again, I mentioned the Gnostic Media bookmarks that have the fallacies on the back, and that those go out with each book order, and we also sell those individually for those interested or actually in a group of 3 or a dozen. We also have the first 4 years of the Gnostic Media podcast up on the website, and this episode was made possible by David, Kieran, Ryan, Joseph, Tommy, Stephen, Jeremy, and Darren. Thanks to all of you for making this episode happen. And of course, we do our best to provide just about everything here for free that we can, so your donations and website purchases are greatly appreciated. This show is run on donations on our website sales. This is not corporate media, but independent media in the truest sense of the words. And of course, by donating or ordering one of the books, a DVD, the She Who Remembers audio archives, a t-shirt, or getting a membership to download the older podcasts, you help to continue this unprogramming. And of course, we greatly appreciate your support. The views expressed by the authors and guests of this unprogram are their own and are not necessarily those held by myself, the host, or Gnostic Media. You can check out the website at www.gnosticmedia.com. That's GNOSTICmedia.com. You can contact me through the contact form on the website or directly at contact@gnosticmedia.com. Thanks for listening and thank you for your support. And here is my interview with Dr. Colin Ross, part 3. Conclusion on MKUltra and mind control. Enjoy. Dr. Colin Ross, welcome back to the Gnostic Media Podcast for your third week back in a row here, going on into this deep discussion on mind control and MKUltra.
Pleasure to be here, of course.
And so I want to just kind of pick up where we left off. You know, we ended up having so much material to cover that one interview turned into two, turned into three. So this week I'm going to attempt to stay more on focus. Last week our discussion really exposed a lot on MKUltra Subproject 58, and you had provided those documents which had actually enabled us to really prove the last of our thesis, the material that you had. So thank you for that, and we put out a lot of work on that over the last week. But what I wanted to start off with today is really how you treat somebody who has undergone mind control or mind control experimentation.
Okay. First, if you don't mind, I'd just like to say that I'd like to dedicate this hour talk to all the Boston victims, including the people directly injured, the families, and the first responders. And besides that, just touched me in general, it touched me because I'm training for a half marathon myself and have run marathons in the past. And I know one person who left the finish line area 5 minutes before the first explosion, so touch me a little closer than it might otherwise.
Well, one of my questions was going to be, what do you think of mass shootings and the like as forms of mind control? And these things usually seem to end up being false flag type operations. So, you know, what do you think about that and the tie-in?
Well, the jury's out, obviously, on Boston, and I think all options are open. Little unlikely it's just a single guy. So, but it's single guy. It's the same thing every time. Options are single guy, false flag, domestic terrorist, foreign terrorist. And of course, the domestic or foreign terrorist can be the patsy of the false flag. So, I don't feel like I've got absolutely rock-solid, firm conclusions on 9/11, but I've got the flight path of the aircraft that went into the Pentagon seems pretty impossible to maneuver for guys who did a couple hours in Cessnas. The hole in the Pentagon is kind of fishy with the absence of wing marks on the building, absence of any kind of drag marks on the ground from the engines. Building 7 seems very suspicious. It doesn't make sense that steel melts at 500 degrees centigrade higher than the combustion point of jet fuel. So I'm aware of all those kind of things. I would say Oklahoma City bombing, I don't buy the conventional story on that at all. And the Mobile Live video, to me, seems extremely well done, well argued. So that looks like either a botched undercover operation or a false flag to me. Now, it was interesting just last night listening to one of the commentators talking about, you know, could Boston be foreign or domestic terrorists? And the person had pointed out, many people pointed out that, well, we've got the bombing at the Atlanta Olympics, which is just a single guy apparently. Then we've got Oklahoma City, which was domestic terrorists. And then we have Waco. Like, they just threw Waco in as if the terrorists incinerated themselves or something. Like, what the heck? Doesn't make any sense at all.
So, you know, Waco, they didn't do anything. In fact, Janet Reno and the Bureau of Tobacco and Firearms, the ATF, came and descended on them and killed some 80 people, including the children.
Right, exactly. Which nobody disputes that fact. So it just shows you how garbled and misperceived the general public discourse is in the mainstream media. So I would say, clearly, if there are false flags, which I wouldn't say with certainty, but high level of suspicion, then they're obviously for controlling the mental state, the attitudes, the behavior of the masses. So that's crystal clear that that would be mind control. And it would be not just something casual. It would be very operational and thought out and do a lot of meetings about it and so on. And be very compartmentalized, obviously.
So going back to my first question, how do you treat people who have undergone mind control experimentation?
Well, I have a series of books that go back to the first one of 1989 about how to treat people with dissociative disorders. And most of my focus is on people with really serious traumatic childhoods and who've undergone kind of an informal mind control program inside their own families. So I have a focus on dissociative disorders, which includes multiple personality disorder, which is now called dissociative identity disorder. But when you're dealing with somebody with complex childhood trauma, you're always dealing with post-traumatic stress disorder, dissociative disorder, depression, and very frequently substance abuse, panic disorder, obsessive compulsive disorder, all kinds of stuff. So dealing with victims of mind control always means that you got to pay attention to all kinds of mental health problems. So that's point number one. And then my 1995 book is called Satanic Ritual Abuse, Principles of Treatment. And the principles in there pretty much apply to the principles of treatment for anybody with government, military, paramilitary, intelligence, mind control, or destructive cult mind control. So that it's all kind of the same universe. And in the Satanic Ritual Abuse book, of course, this is in the height of the false memory wars and false memory controversies. And there's people on Amazon, actually, there's two reviews, one after the other, of the Satanic Ritual Abuse book. One reviewer saying, this Colin Ross is a disgrace and public menace, and he's creating all these false memories. The next review is saying, Colin Ross is a no good guy because he doesn't believe the survivors. So, I mean, that just shows you how amazingly polarized it is and how the same book can be perceived as pure black or pure white. So, in terms of treating people, the main point of the book is I go through a bunch of history of destructive cults, the history of not Satanism, but Satan, like his various, you know, manifestations and images of him from 6800 AD through the medieval period, modern times. And well, that was just a whole bunch of interesting background reading historically. And then actually verified existing destructive cults, a set of context. And my main point is about how to do the therapy. But as soon as you start talking about the therapy, especially back in the 90s when there was this false memory wars, everybody always wanted to get you on the topic of, is it real or not real? And one constituency, if you said it's real, they thought you're an idiot. The other constituency, if you said it's not real, they thought you were a horrible person. So you can never please everybody all the time. And to me, that was from the perspective of a clinician and a therapist, that was all just a huge distraction. And the field actually kind of bought into the agenda set by the False Memory Syndrome Foundation, which had on it, the Professional Advisory Board, had on it two verified top secret cleared MKUltra contractors. So this was clearly, you know, tied into CIA disinformation, mind control, etc. And what they set the agenda as was, it's crucial to decide, is it real, is it not real? And if you decide it's real, you'll do therapy A, and if you decide it's not real, you'll do therapy B. This is stated by clinicians. People who aren't therapists have no experience with treatment, don't know anything about clinical stuff at all. And then the field kind of bought into that and became very invested in, no, we think it's real, which then just fueled the opposite side to say, you guys are all idiots because you think it's real when it's not. So my basic strategy was to take a meta position in terms of the public debate, because the fact of the matter is, I don't know for a fact that X amount of satanic ritual abuse was real, and I didn't know for a fact that it wasn't real. I'm not an investigator, I'm not a police officer. I don't have the resources, I don't have the mandate, I don't have the expertise to investigate a claim from like 20, 30 years ago about somebody's childhood. So there's no possibility for me to either verify or disprove the claim of the individual. So therefore, what am I going to do as a clinician? And the metaphysician, I sum it up with a kind of cute little phrase, just because I don't believe you doesn't mean I don't believe you. Meaning, the society in general, people who are in the big debate about is satanic retributions real or not real, are all assuming that there's only two positions to take. You actively believe it, or you actively disbelieve it. But what I said is, no, there's another position, which is called therapeutic neutrality in the clinical literature. And that is, I don't either actively believe it or actively disbelieve it. So just because I don't believe you doesn't mean I don't believe you. I'm taking sort of a meta position of neutrality, which is consistent with the facts. Namely, I don't know for a fact that it happened, and I don't know for a fact that it didn't happen. And so when you take that position, then the whole controversy about how much of it's real and how much isn't just evaporates. And what you're dealing with is a human being who has all these memories. And very commonly, so I'm just talking about satanic ritual abuse, but the same principles apply to any form of mind control. Very commonly, the person has multiple personality disorder. And very commonly, they have parts that completely believe that it did happen, and parts that completely believe that it didn't happen. So the first problem is, if you align yourself with any one group of parts, then you're automatically disaligning yourself with the other, which means that you're not able to form a treatment relationship with those parts. You're not able to have any empathy. You can't bring them on board in the therapy process, and you just created internal enemies for yourself. So the only way not to offend anybody and not to create enemies is to take this position of neutrality. And then instead of, I'm the outside authority, and I know what reality is, and I'm either going to tell you it is real or tell you it's not real, instead of taking that position, the position I take is, this is a problem inside you. You've got parts of yourself that really are intensely invested in it's real, parts that are intensely invested in it's not real. And the only way to resolve this is to work internally and figure out how to come to a resolution. So that's kind of the general principle. Then to illustrate it with an example, this is more so back in the 90s, but still we have people, a smaller number of people who are describing satanic ritual abuse currently. So a typical scenario was, say there's a satanic holiday, satanic ceremony, which is the summer solstice. So the person comes into the hospital on, say, June 12th because they're acutely suicidal, but they also say that their satanic cult elders are going to take them to the ceremony on June 21st and participate in the sacrifice of a baby, and that's why they're in the hospital, and you can't possibly discharge me until after June 21st. So then this is setting up a victim, a rescuer, and a perpetrator, which is part of the treatment model. We're always looking at the victim, rescuer, perpetrator triangle. So the perpetrator is the satanic alter personality on the inside. The victim is the host personality who's going to get dragged to the satanic ceremony, not to mention the victim in the ceremony. And the rescuer is going to be the mental health professional who's going to come in and save the day and rescue the innocent out front adult personality, who's probably a Christian, from the horrible Satanists who want to kill babies. But as soon as you get into that, then you're just a player in the internal war. You don't have any therapeutic leverage. You're not in a therapeutically neutral position. So again, I would turn it into a problem that's inside the person. But the way I had to figure out, the person who's out front, who's kind of in charge of most of life, is called the host personality, just by convention. So I had to figure out how to get the satanic alters on board with the therapy, and simultaneously how to get the host on board, so that they're inching towards working together as a team instead of having an internal civil war. So one thing I figured out, just by listening and talking, is, okay, what are these satanic alter personalities who've been programmed by the cult leader actually saying? If you translate it from they would say stuff like, he is the leader, Satan is in charge, you know, all kinds of sort of mumbo-jumbo. And what I did for myself was translate it into normal English so that I could then present the translated version to the host personality. So the translated version is, I really like hanging out with my dad, because dad was always the high priest who was the head of the cult. I want to do stuff with him that he's interested in, and I want him to spend time with me and be proud of me. So if dad's a Satanist who kills babies, the way you're going to do that is by going to participate in the ceremony. So I de-escalate it down from all the kind of drama and horror of the Satanism to just a normal, everyday, completely natural, I'd like to be in a relationship with my dad, I'd like to hang out with them, I'd like them to do stuff with me and be proud of me. So then I went and presented that idea to the host personality. And while I'm presenting it to the host personality, the satanic parts are always listening in the background. And so I say, the problem is that you've got a lot of ambivalent feelings about your dad. One part of you says, I never want to see him again. He's a Satanist. I'm a Christian. Another part of you says, he's the most important person in my life, and he's my pipeline to Satan, and I want to hang out with him and be with him. So that's clearly, looking at you as a whole person, a very conflicted, ambivalent attachment to your dad. And what you're doing, you the host personality, is kind of a double defense. You're saying to yourself, and you're making it be internally real to yourself, that's not me, that's them. They're Satanists, and I'm a Christian. So there's a double defense. First of all, they're not me, because they're them. They're these other people inside. They're programmed, I'm not. And then there's the theological defense of, they're Satanists, I'm a Christian, I would never do something like that. But the problem is that these are parts of yourself. These are disavowed, disowned impulses, ideas, feelings, thoughts of your own. And all that they really want to do, if you boil it down, is have a dad that's fun to do things with. That doesn't sound so weird. That doesn't sound satanic. That sounds perfectly normal. So this is a whole process to sell this idea to the person. But the basic concept is, as I said, the neutrality. It's not about whether it's real or not real. It's about how are you going to resolve the internal conflict inside the person. And to do that, you got to start talking to both factions in a way that makes sense to them. So one way I would do that with the satanic parts is, they might either come out, take control of the body, and I talk to them directly, or I talk to them indirectly with the host personality up front, with them listening in the background. And so I actually would say to people, okay, hold on, you guys. First of all, I want to explain something. And so this, if it's 1994, I'd be talking about 1994. But if it's 2013, I'd be saying, I just want to check out with you guys what year you would say it is right now. And not uncommon, they say it's 1973. I'd say, okay, it's 1973. And where are you currently? Ohio. Okay. And are you living at home with your mom and your dad, brothers and sisters? Yeah. And you're in eighth grade at school. Right. Okay. And where are we right now? I don't know. Some room. Okay. So then I would say to them, and all of this, I'm just giving you the quick version. It's all a process. You got to go over it, go over it. So basically, I would explain to them that my view of it is that the year is 2013, and that they live inside the body of Susan or Mary, who's now 46 years old or 38 years old. And the last time that your body was ever in the same place as your dad and those guys who do all that satanic stuff was 17 years ago or 23 years ago or whatever it is. So the good news is you're not involved in that anymore. The bad news is you're not involved in that anymore, depending on which way you want to look at it. But when you say that you want to go to the ceremony 6 days from now on June 21st, you're thinking you're going to do that in 1976. But it's not 1976, it's 2013. So now we've introduced a whole other dimension to the conversation, because the issue is not, is it real in 1976? The issue now is, okay, whether it was or wasn't real in 1976, it's not happening now. So therefore, there's no need to threaten her or kill her or do whatever it takes to get back to the ceremony on the 21st, because I might not want to mention too fast that the dad died, because then that's going to bring up a whole bunch of grief. Because these people, the satanic parts, are insulated from their own grief, because they don't even know that dad died, because he died in 1997, they think it's 1976. So I want to kind of leave that for a little later, because I don't want to throw into all that too much, too fast. So then I'll have a discussion with the parts in the background or parts out front. Take a look at your feet. Okay, whose shoes are those? Oh, those are her shoes. Well, how did her shoes get on your feet? And I'll often have, take a look at your hand. So I'll ask the host personnel to raise your hand and look at it, and I'll ask the parts in the background, look through her eyes and look at her hand there. Does that look like a 12-year-old boy's hand? No, that's a 48-year-old woman's hand. And there's a wedding ring on it. And if the parts out front, say it's a 13-year-old boy, I might say, how long is your hair? Buzz cut. Okay. Just check your hair. And he'll go and be like totally astounded. There's this hair that comes down to his shoulders. And when I did that with one part who wasn't satanic, he actually went, am I a hippie? So there's a lot of tragedy and a lot of comedy rolled into all of this. So I'm trying to get them to see that they actually live inside a grown-up female body, which is then fits with, it's now 2013, because it takes all those years for the body to grow up. And then I ask them, I invite them, I suggest that they look out through her eyes, look at the TV, look at newspapers, look at magazines. Now, this could be a trick that I'm playing because I've got everything under control in this little room. But when she's discharged and leaves the hospital, you can go to the supermarket, you can go around, the cars are going to be different, hairstyles and clothes are different, and you're going to notice this is not Ohio. So if you build up all of this evidence for yourself, I don't have to talk you into this 2013. You'll see it for yourself, and it'll really sink in, and then you'll know. Until then, I don't expect you to believe me. That's kind of the approach. And then I might say to the satanic parts, again, with them on the inside or up front, let me give you a little advice about how the healthcare system works. So I say it's 2013, you say it's 1976, but it is true that June 21st is 5 days away. If you want to get out of the hospital before June 21st, here's how the system works. We cannot discharge you if you're actively threatening suicide. If you want to get out of the hospital, you've got to settle down, stop threatening suicide, and at least create the illusion that it's safe enough for her to be discharged. Otherwise, you're going to be stuck in here and June 21st is going to go by. So this is kind of a paradoxical strategy, because now they're going, oh, okay, now I got to pretend I'm not suicidal. But the thing is, you've actually finessed them a little bit into not being suicidal for real, because if they kill her, the body's going to die, which they didn't realize previously. They thought they could kill her because they have their own separate bodies. But now by looking at the hands, feeling the hair, it starts to sink in, okay, if we kill her and we kill the body, then we can't go to the ceremony on the 21st. So it's in our interest to stop with the suicidal ideation, stop threatening to kill her, and just kind of fake it that we're okay so we can get out so we can go to the ceremony. Which I don't have to worry about that they're actually going to go to the ceremony with Dad, because I already know that Dad died in 1997 and the body hasn't had any contact with any of his people since 1983 or something. So you might want to interject once in a while and ask a question, but I'm just giving you some of the flavor of the kind of strategy.
I didn't want to interrupt you there. So, yeah, that's interesting. I can see the process that you want to sort of lead people out. I can also see that this is where some people might, even though you're not implanting the actual ideas, you're just asking them the questions, people who don't really read your work, which is always the case, will say that you're planting memories.
Right. But they're just going to say that no matter what, some people. I mean, some people absolutely are locked in their position, cannot be persuaded. So I was giving a workshop about 2 years ago, roughly, in Michigan. And it was on trauma and treatment strategy and stuff. And the audience seemed to like it. It's all clinicians. And at the end, this guy stands up and just, like, starts hurling, you know, slander at me, basically. That I've never been to a presentation like this. This is ridiculous. You're a fringe nut. You've been famous for creating false memories for decades. And I've never been to a talk by a psychiatrist in which no single fact was ever stated. So it's because it's all just like make-believe fantasy ideas that I'm constructing. And then he actually had with him a 1989 newspaper article from the Winnipeg Sun, which is a fairly tabloidy newspaper. You know, I can't even remember what the content of the article was. This was his evidence that I was the lunatic. And so he said, "You're a fringe person." So my comeback was, and in the end, I just had to tell him we're not going to spend any more time on this because he's not going to shift his position at all. But let me give you my refutation for "you're a fringe nut." Okay, that can't actually be true because I've got 170 publications in peer-reviewed journals, many of them presenting original data with all kinds of statistics, and that includes a series of 7 or 8 in the American Journal of Psychiatry, which is one of the higher-ranking journals in the world. My name's in the back of the DSM-4. Because I was part of the DSM-4 process. And I published textbooks with 3 mainstream academic publishers. University of Toronto Press, 2 books. John Wiley and Sons, 2 books. And the Hayworth Press. And, this doesn't fit with the stereotype of a fringe nut. He goes, and so his comment was, "Oh, well, you have a reputation." So there's some people who just fixed in idiocy, basically, and you can't persuade them.
Sure. Well, you know, some people, you know, think with fallacies, and this person is obviously just using ad hominem attacks at you, and that's usually a sign of someone's own intellectual bankruptcy when all they can do is hurl insults at you and not deal with any of the information that you've presented. Right. You know, it's just a common trick of people who, you know, we were discussing briefly the trivium before we started the interview, but this would be somebody who, as we would say, they put their logic before their grammar. They try to reach an understanding of why something is before they have any knowledge of who, what, where, or when.
Right.
And so all they can do is basically, you know, they don't have any valid information to come to a conclusion, so all they can do is hurl insults.
Right. In the more scholarly, which is pseudo-scholarly literature, where it's in a journal and there's an attack on multiple personality is not real, there's just a whole list of examples of what you're saying. One is, so I literally learned this in elementary school, like in 5th grade. What is a scientific method? Well, you make an observation, then you construct a hypothesis concerning your observation. Then you test your hypothesis with an experiment. And then you look at the results. And the results either support the hypothesis or don't. So what happens in this crazy pseudo-debate about the reality of multiple personality? In the psychiatry literature, the False Memory Syndrome Foundation board members will say, well, we know that multiple personality is just a North American fad, because there's more cases diagnosed inside North America than outside North America. But that's the observation. The hypothesis that they have to explain the observation is that it's just a fad stirred up by crazy therapists in North America, and we don't have those kind of crazy therapists outside North America. But the alternative hypothesis is there's a group of clinicians in North America who are more tuned in to this, so they make the diagnosis more often. The prevalence or the frequencies varies from country to country, but you can find cases all around the world. And if you went there and did systematic studies, you would find such cases. So the opposite.
Well, and then when you go and do a search for these things, they don't always show up across multi-language barriers and
right.
the like.
But the from a rhetoric point of view, the point is that the observation is equally compatible with both hypotheses. But the false memory guys use the observation to prove their hypothesis, but it's equally compatible with the opposing hypothesis. And then they don't go to what's the evidence.
Sure. Have you heard
a closed tautological
paper
loop.
By David Dunning and Justin Kruger called Unskilled and Unaware of It, How Difficulties in Recognizing One's Own Incompetence Lead to Self-Inflated inflated self-assessments? It's a really good paper.
The title's fantastic.
Sure.
No, I haven't read it.
It's essentially it's to get people to understand that whenever you approach any topic or any subject to study, if you just admit from the instant that you're starting out, I'm incompetent, and then work from there,
right.
you're building out that grammar, the all of the who, what, where, and when, so that you know exactly what you're dealing with. So, you know, a lot of people don't understand the concept when they approach any topic of study to approach as they're completely ignorant and incompetent, and then go from there until they have all of the information and they've systematically processed it, removed all of the crap and contradictions, and then they can derive a valid conclusion from it. So yeah, it's a really good
article. But then that violates the other principle of rhetoric, which is don't confuse me with the facts.
Indeed. Yeah. Don't confuse me with the facts. I've already made up my mind. So let me see here. What was my next question for you? What do you know about humanism and transhumanism used as mind control?
Kind of nothing in a way. Are you thinking of like some specific people or? Because those are such broad.
Well, you know, sure. I mean, you know, obviously we would need to, for humanism, we would need to go with, modern humanism or, what's the proper word I'm looking for? Anyway, secular humanism. And obviously most of that stuff is coming out of both, especially Julian. Julian, in fact, coined the term transhumanism. And he's the one that promoted all of the modern humanism. And then, of course, he and his brother were the key guys behind MKUltra and many of the modern eugenics programs running today.
I've actually got several book reviews and an essay in press on that are related to this topic. And so Richard Dawkins is a current biologist who's an ardent atheist. And my basic analysis, so he obviously gets in the whole debate about creationism versus evolution. And then the people who oppose him have their own set of logical fallacies and false arguments, which he then is good at pointing out and tearing down. But so far, the opposing people from the religious community, which is mostly Christian people, haven't, I don't think, quite spotted his game and called him on his game. And so what he says is, one of his books is called The Blind Watchmaker. And the basic thesis is that there's no God, there is no spirit, there's no prime cause moving the history of the universe along. So it's a empty universe without spirit, without God, without soul. And this is proven by the science of evolution. And that there's no need to hypothesize God reaching in with his finger, because when we see all the mechanisms, we can explain everything without that. And so it comes across as kind of a reasonable argument.
It's a bit of a begging the question, though. It's like the Christian argument.
It's totally begging.
Right. You know, here, how do I know that God exists? Oh, look, it's right here in the Bible.
Right. Right. So then you get absurd non-proofs on both sides. But the game that atheistic biologists play, and Dawkins is a very good example of this because he's written at length. So first of all, he's a really bright guy. And he really like grasped the micro details of evolution. Because evolution is not just sort of a broad brushstroke model. It goes down into details of biochemistry, details of, you know, how genetics are conserved across species and all these things. And he understands all that thoroughly, argues it out very well. But in the middle of that, he says that there is no watchmaker equals God. It's just the blind forces of evolution, just like the blind forces of physics, unrolling through mutation and natural selection. And so, first of all, there's a problem that he doesn't recognize, because he says that human consciousness of a human watchmaker has direction, purpose, and a goal to it. So the criteria for being a watchmaker are: you design a watch with conscious purpose, you're aware of what you're doing, and there's a series of steps behind it. So there is a watchmaker who makes the watch, and that watch has the watchmaker has the property of being conscious, having purpose, having a direction. So, but if there's, then the whole phrase a blind watchmaker doesn't make sense, because he's attributed to the watchmaker the quality of consciousness, mind, and spirit. But he says that there is no watchmaker in nature. Nature just kind of makes itself.
Right.
But then the absurdity is, okay, so if there's no God, no soul, no spirit, then how does anybody read your book? I mean, it's so self-evident, so basic. So then you have to go, well, there's no God consciousness, but human beings have consciousness. But consciousness is an emergent property of the human brain. So rocks don't have consciousness. The universe doesn't have consciousness. Plants don't have consciousness. Animals maybe got a little bit, but not much. And human beings are the only ones with language and with a full kind of consciousness. And so then the doctrine becomes, so then we get over to the mind-body problem. So now we Dawkins and atheistic biologists are asserting a doctrine where you can't say we're all dead and unconscious. It's just too absurd. Even though the universe is dead and the universe has no consciousness and there's no consciousness before the human race, it's just too absurd to say none of us are conscious. Because if we're all dead and unconscious, we can't even read Dawkins' book and nothing matters anyway, so why don't we just be quiet and go home? So then we get into, well, how does the brain generate consciousness? Well, we have to say rocks don't generate consciousness, plants don't, lower animals don't. And they don't say, well, your elbow generates consciousness. Of course, they say your brain generates consciousness. And then it's not even all of your brain. For instance, your lower brainstem is just automatic. It's only part of the cerebral cortex that generates consciousness. And then the problem becomes multiple. One thing is, nobody has demonstrated any scientific physiological difference between the neurological principles, the physiology in your cortex up here where you're thinking, compared to your cortex back here, which is the visual cortex, compared to deeper in your brain. So how come there's some conscious neurons and some unconscious neurons when there's no demonstrable physical difference between the properties of these neurons? So then you get to this absurd thing about, oh, it's an emergent property of complex systems. Okay. So how does water emerge from a tap? Okay, we can actually study that. Here it is, emerging. How does the dew emerge on the grass? There's a whole science of that. So there's all kinds of things that emerge that are very well studied and specified in science. But there's absolutely zero mechanism, zero hypothesis, there's nothing in science whatsoever that makes even the most preliminary statement about how mind emerges from the brain. So they just say, it emerges, and if you don't agree with us, you're some kind of religious nut, and you're not being scientific. So what's actually going on here is, first of all, they're completely fudging over the mind-body problem and pretending like we've got that pretty much solved and you primitive people are still talking about God, but we're scientists. But what they actually are doing it's a Trojan horse maneuver. They're bringing atheism into the discussion. They're cloaking atheism with the authority of science. And they're saying that if you don't agree with our atheism, you're being anti-scientific. But science is completely neutral on whether there is or isn't a God, whether there isn't a long spirit. And then, so then I go to the animate, inanimate matter distinction. So all these scientists say, yeah, there's animate matter and there's inanimate matter. So rocks are inanimate, human beings are animate. So these are two categories of matter. But there's no soul, no spirit, no life force, no karma, no chi energy, no whatever you want to call it. There's none of it. There's just the forces of physics. So the universe kind of evolved from the Big Bang up to the level of we're in the ocean. There's no biology. Then some chemicals kind of come together, and then they get encapsulated in some lipids, and then we get some mRNA. And it's all just chemistry. There's no life. And then all of a sudden, around about 3.7 billion years ago, life emerged. So they say that life emerged, and they put a date on it, and they say it's just the blind forces of the blind watchmaker, the blind forces of physics, which became the blind forces of chemistry, which became the blind forces of biochemistry. So life emerging in the ocean 3.7 billion years ago is exactly the same logic as consciousness emerging from the brain. But how can life emerge? There's got to be some new property that didn't exist before life emerged. Otherwise, nothing is emerging. It's just a bunch of atoms.
Right, just a random mix, and all of a sudden, one of those random mixes suddenly clicked, and then there was life. But then how does it go on from there to constantly evolve if it's just random mixes?
Well, then they'll say that it evolves through the forces of mutation and selection.
Sure.
But the logical problem is, if there is no God, soul, spirit, mind, consciousness, life force, then nothing emerged 3.7 billion years ago. All that happened was the new biochemistry.
Sure.
So what's with this? So they make a statement that's disallowed by their own rules. Because what they're really trying to do, again, is force this atheism down everybody's throat while cloaking it in the authority of science. And so then I'll just spend a little bit more on this. So one of the arguments I make is, okay, we've got a pregnant woman who's iron is low and her hemoglobin is low. So we want to prescribe iron. So every doctor, every biologist, every evolutionist agrees the iron is dead. It's inanimate matter. So we dug it up from the earth. It was there for a bazillion years. It was dead. Then we put it in a capsule. It goes down the woman's esophagus, goes into her bloodstream. And then at some point, it gets incorporated into hemoglobin molecule in a red blood cell, and now it's part of a living person. So the iron atom was dead, and now it's alive. But the red blood cells only last for about 100 days or so. Then the hemoglobin's breaking down. It's excreted, goes through the sewage system. Now the iron atom is dead again. So this is the reincarnation cycle of an iron atom. But there's no possibility within the rules of the scientific system that an iron atom can be dead and then become alive and then become dead. That's absurd and not allowed. So, but if one iron atom is dead, then just because you put two atoms together, you've just got 2 times 0. So there's 0 life in the atom. Now you got a couple of carbon atoms and some nitrogen and some other stuff. But all these individual atoms have 0 life in them. So the formula for the amount of life in a single atom is 1 times 0 equals 0, right? But if you take 10 to the 27th or 227th dead atoms and multiply them by 0, you still have 0. So there's no logical way within the system of atheism that dead atoms can become alive and that there can be any fundamental difference between animate matter and inanimate matter. Because the fundamentals of the difference are disallowed. So again, they're talking about, we all know that some matter is alive and some matter is dead, but they disallow life. But yet they keep talking about it. So this is the kind of logical fallacy that goes on with atheism cloaking itself in the authority of science and then saying, if you don't agree with us, you're unscientific, which is a form of intimidation, bullying, and you could say cultural mind control, which is trying to get rid of any kind of spirituality or meaning or purpose for life. So then we're all just a bunch of robots and you can do whatever you want.
Sure. Have you heard of Paul Churchward's work? He wrote a book called The Engine of Reason and the Seat of the Soul. He has an interesting hypothesis, and interestingly also the quadrivium, the way that it lays things out, gives another possible way that consciousness comes about, but it's definitely not out of the current system that's sold. Also, last year I interviewed, which is rare for me, I actually interviewed this this Canadian Christian televangelist, Ian T. Taylor. And he's got a book, In the Minds of Men, Darwin and the New World Order. And he had a lot of fantastic research in there. And so when I was researching the background of Aldous and Julian Huxley and their ties into MKUltra and all of this good stuff, somebody had sent me his work. And so I contacted him and he agreed to come on the show. And of course, trying to just stick to the facts with how all of his religious sales pitches was a little bit tough, but we still, I think, got a pretty good interview out of the guy. I think he's about 83 years old now.
Well, all power to him on that count.
But let me see. Let me go back over here. Last week we talked about Project MKUltra running through, the CIA funding it through the Human Ecology Foundation, the Human Ecology Fund. Did you want to go any more into the Human Ecology Foundation, or did we cover them enough last week?
Well, just one little, we mostly covered it enough, but one little additional anecdote, which is just the kind of mind-boggling, you're kidding me aspect of this. Doing this research, you find out, okay, this guy's involved. Then you find out, okay, that guy's involved. And then you go to the journal and go, oh, now this guy's connected in. And so there's this, there's various revered people in the history of psychiatry who are famous. So this Freud's famous, and, Skinner's favorite for behaviorism and so on. And Carl Rogers is famous for client-centered humanistic psychology. So I didn't actually learn much about him when I was in my psychiatry training, but he was in the multiple choice exam. And if the question was, who was the founder of client-centered psychotherapy? It wasn't Freud, it wasn't Jung. You knew the answer, it was Carl Rogers. And the stereotype of this client-centered therapy is all the kind of touchy-feely. I hear you saying that you feel badly. I hear you saying that you're angry at your mother. That must be difficult. So that's kind of the stereotype of it. But it's all nice and kind and touchy-feely, and it's humanistic, and it's respect for humans, and it's centered on the client. Lo and behold, I think it's MKUltra Subproject 97, if I remember right. Top secret clearance, Carl Rogers, study of psychotherapy of schizophrenia. And then I get the 1961 report of the Human Ecology Foundation. Lo and behold, Carl Rogers is on the board deciding who's getting the grants from the Human Ecology Foundation, which is 100.0% CIA funding from, where the MKUltra money is given to the foundation, which then awards the grants, which is a built-in deniability. And so this guy who's the most humanistic, client-centered guy is a top-secret cleared CIA mind control contractor. And obviously the CIA is not trying to find out how to be the most touchy-feely therapist. It just goes, are you kidding me, Carl Rogers?
What about Subproject 103 and the studies that were done on children?
The first point to remember, which I think I might have mentioned before, is MKUltra gets all the press and all the attention. But actually, MKUltra is not even the most sinister of the declassified programs. Project Often was way worse. They're putting people on drugs like BZ and so on, wildly psychotic, hallucinating, picking at bugs, scared, for 4 days before they would come down. And really toxic side effects, people dying, etc. So the MKUltra kind of falls into three clumps. There's top secret cleared mind control contractors like Martin Orne and Jolly West who are doing psychological mind manipulation stuff. Then there's another group of top secret contractors who are just kind of providing chemicals and providing bacteria and so on. So they're basically just supply houses cleared at top secret. Nothing much to do with psychology as such. They're just chemists or biologists or whatever they are. Then there's another group of unwitting contractors, some of whom, like Wasson and Ewan Cameron, undoubtedly, in fact, were perfectly winning, cleared at top secret. The unwitting documentation is just cover story. But in the unwitting group, I think there's some people who actually, in reality, were unwitting that it was CIA money. And there's four MKUltra sub-projects involving children, all of which it says that the investigators were unwitting. So maybe anywhere between zero and four of them were actually unwitting. But the it also says elsewhere, I can't remember if it's in the documents, I think it's in the Search for the Manchurian Candidate book, that Sidney Gottlieb, the head of MKUltra, explains, we just wanted to fund a lot of people just to see what came up and also to form relationships with people who might be of future interest to the agency. And so 103 is the International Children's Summer Villages, which was somewhere in the Northeast. I forget it. Might have been Connecticut. But anyway, it's in the Northeast. And it says in the project documents that the purpose of it is you've got all these children from all kinds of different countries who come together to the summer camp, and they don't share a common language. And the purpose of the investigator is looking at how kids communicate when they don't share a common language. So it's like a language communication academic study. And supposedly the investigator is unwitting. And I think in that case, he actually was. And the reason I think that is there wasn't anything sinister in the documents at all. What it does say in the document is the purpose of this project is to provide cover to establish a relationship with young foreign nationals who might be of future interest to the agency. So the whole academic research thing is of no interest whatsoever to the CIA. It just gives them the opportunity to go in there and try and recruit kids to become spies and work for them as adults.
Do you think go ahead.
And then the other three projects, I can't remember all of the other three, study of sort of gang behavior in Oklahoma City. Other one was, I just remember that they're relatively bland. You know, you wouldn't go, ooh, that's sinister.
Do you think that it's possible that there's been an over-promotion of the Manchurian candidate type of mind control to lead people away from some of the other many various facets of mind control, such as, you know, the use of logical fallacies, for instance, just in the mainstream media, et cetera, is a, you know, you can control tens of thousands of people at once with that. You know, the one thing that I see is, like, you know, with MKUltra and a lot of this stuff, the focus seems to be on the John Marks Manchurian candidate type of thing. But all of these other forms of mind control are seem to be almost whitewashed.
I agree. And the reason I agree is I think the same things applies to the UFO controversy. I think that the military and the intelligence community is actively running both sides, the believers and the non-believers, just to create a whole distraction.
Absolutely. And I fully agree with that.
And I think that's true whether there actually are aliens in our atmosphere or it's all experimental military craft. Doesn't matter. Either way, that's true. And so I think that's also true in the parapsychology arena, because you look at parapsychology, so there's it's fringe from a point of view of mainstream academia, but there's some in mainstream academia, and there's the believers and the disbelievers, and they're always fighting each other. But we know that the CIA, through Stargate and related programs, funded all kinds of parapsychological studies for decades. So they're simultaneously discrediting and mocking and making fun of and marginalizing the thing that they're spending a lot of money developing. So it's a distraction and a cover simultaneously. And I think the same has been true with multiple personality disorder, that the actual contractors like Jolly West and Martin Oren are part of an organization that's attacking it, discrediting it, marginalizing it. But it's the only psychiatric disorder that they're creating on purpose. So it's actually the most interesting disorder to them. And they see the reality and utility of it operationally. And then with the Manchurian candidate, I'm interested in it because of the ethics of psychiatry and the history of psychiatry and the total violation of human decency, basic medical ethics, consent, all that, when you're doing that to an individual human being. So that's why I'm focused on that. But as soon as you get into that, you right away see that it's the same path back actually as Jolly West followed, that he was a military guy debriefing down the Korean pilots. He then became a mind control contractor expert for the CIA, and then he became an expert on destructive cults. So as soon as you go into this, you automatically...
Where did Lee Harvey Oswald and Jack Ruby and Patty Hearst and all that, were they before or after he became an expert on cults?
Well, they're all just part of the whole process. But I'm just using him as an example of, even if you're Louis Jolin and West, and you try and have this narrow Manchurian candidate focus, it just opens you back up into this very broad universe of mind control automatically, when if you're a scholar or whoever you are. So I agree with you that it's the same basic strategy. Because John Marx's book says, poo-poo, the Manchurian candidate was really just fiction. They never were successful at making one. So that could just be a pure disinformation or misinformation. But it also serves the purpose of focusing the whole debate over here so that we're not talking over there. So I absolutely agree with you.
Are you familiar with the English magician Darren Brown's work, who recreated the Jack Ruby assassination last year on national TV? Yeah, his show has slowly gained popularity over here. I've been into his work for probably 10 years. But he always exposes... You know, his show is about how magicians and hypnotists and these types of people do all of their tricks. And I mean, he's tricked advertising agents into drawing his exact diagram by planting images that he intentionally had taxi cab drivers drive them past and things like that. But he has this guy walk into a theater and shoot this guy. I forget the guy's name. He was in V for Victory or V for Vendetta, whatever that, that film was. And, you know, the guy who plays the news host in that show.
Yeah, I saw the movie, but I don't remember that guy.
Sure. So you know, this guy, Darren Brown, hypnotizes this guy to walk into a movie theater in front of everybody. And, of course, everybody's in on it. And this guy's, you know, under hypnosis. Pulls a fake gun that he thinks is real and loaded, pulls the trigger three times right in the middle of the theater, and mock guns this guy down right in front of everybody.
Yeah, there's experiments like that described in great detail in the Bluebird artichoke documents. Same thing. Pulling guns, exchanging a bomb with another courier, and lifting documents, and there's a variety of different tasks all done under hypnosis, including you absolutely think the gun is loaded, you absolutely think that you're shooting an enemy of the state, and then you have amnesia for the whole thing when you're woken up.
Yeah, that's exactly what they did to him. So are you, let's go into John Mulholland. And are you also familiar?
I was just going to say there's a guy named John Mulholland.
Well, are you going to, why don't we go into him and Houdini as well? Because I know both of them were working for the CIA and intelligence community. Both of them show up around, John Mulholland shows up, especially regarding MKUltra. And Houdini is also in there. I was, now I'm forgetting where, but I was reading something just last week where Houdini was running all of these intelligence operations all over Europe when he was on his tours. His whole point was, you know, using his sleight of hand, and while people thought he was behind the cloth, locked up and escaping, he was already out running some operation for 10 or 15 minutes somewhere.
Yeah. I don't know about Houdini. I don't doubt it. But I do know about John Mulholland, who is a top secret cleared MKUltra contractor and magician. And there's several interesting things about that. One is there's only two people I'm aware of where they slipped up and didn't redact the name every time. What are the odds that's a slip up? So that you go through 15,000 pages of documents, all redacted, so nobody's name shows up. The only two names that they slipped up and didn't redact a few times are Sidney Gottlieb and John Mulholland. Sidney Gottlieb being the head of the whole thing. And he was very perturbed about that, Gottlieb was. And so then there's a whole question of why did they select those two guys to be hung up to dry? But what the documents describe is John Mulholland teaching them how to pass documents, use sleight of hand, basically spycraft training type stuff. And there is just a fact that they use magicians as trainers for spycraft. But going into the disinformation mind control aspect of it a little bit more, then John Mulholland gets he's treated with a little bit more respect. Like, he's just, teaching sleight of hand skills. That's kind of straightforward. But part of the whole tone about MKUltra, which goes into you're trying to put stuff into Castro's cigars, trying to, put germs in his wetsuit, trying to slip him LSD, and also goes into putting electrodes in cats, brain electrodes, are trying to control their behavior, use them as listening devices, and using dolphins to deliver bombs and so on. There's this whole disinformation strategy, which is, I think there was a headline way back sometime in a newspaper, the gang that couldn't shoot straight, which is they had an LSD sprayer and it just didn't work because everything just blew away in the wind. And there was a cat that had an electrode implanted in his brain and he could control its behavior. And so they were trying it out and went out in the street and got run over by a truck. And so it's this comical guys who just, looked into the zany stuff and it never worked. And, we don't even fiddle with that anymore, including the mentoring candidate. So that's turning it into this sort of bumbling comedy routine. And John Mulholland doesn't exactly get sucked in there, but he's kind of on the edge of that. And then it's easy to turn Houdini running off for 15 minutes to do something or other into just a ridiculous comedy routine. I mean, it's very easy to discredit.
Indeed. Let's get into, this guy, he says, man doesn't have the right to develop his own brain. Who is that and what was he about?
That would be Jose Delgado, I assume you're talking about?
Yes, that's Jose Delgado.
Yeah, when I give a talk on this, I've got several Jose Delgado slides. So you can actually go on YouTube and just search Jose Delgado controlled bull, or Jose Delgado in the bull ring, Jose Delgado brain electrode implants, and you can see the video where he's a neurosurgeon at Yale. He's an Office of Naval Research contractor, and he supplied some equipment to the brain electrode implant team at Harvard, and he's cross-connected also with Jolly West and a guy at Tulane named Robert Heath. They're all brain electrode implant guys. And so Jose Delgado's got a book that I have a copy of called Physical Control of the Mind. And so this is not vague or you have to read between the lines. He straight up says that his vision of humanity is we're going to evolve to the next level by putting brain electrodes in everybody, except, of course, not Jose Delgado and not a few generals and maybe not the Bilderberg guys.
And if you get this, though, if you realize the cross-connection here, here's where Julian Huxley's transhumanism comes in, because this is them selling the idea. It's essentially their marketing ploy to get us to accept the brain implants and the nanotechnology and all of this stuff, right?
Well, he was literally stating that we're going to control everybody's minds, including even generals, with brain electrodes. So Jolly West, who's one of the MKUltra contractors, he had a project called the UCLA Violence Project. And it was shut down by public protest after it was funded by Ronald Reagan when he was the governor of California. So they were going to take imprisoned sex offenders, put electrodes in their brains, and the electrode would have two purposes. One is they would be a tracking device. So then they were going to use a used Nike missile site as the tracking system, and they would track these guys after they were released from jail. And if they went outside a restricted zone, they would send a signal to their brain, which would immobilize them so the police could pick them up. This is the UCLA Violence Project. The head of the NIMH at one point said that black riders in Watts, their behavior was due to their race and due to being genetically defective, and that we could solve the problem of racial unrest by popping electrodes in the brains of all these guys and controlling their behavior. That was the head of NIMH. So Jose Delgado, like the group at Harvard, and he published a lot of stuff in the mainstream journals. And one series of experiments is, I'll get to the humans first, but I'll do the animals first. So there's dogs, cats, monkeys. So there's a monkey colony, which is in a huge cage, and they're doing their thing inside the cage, living their lives. And there's the alpha monkey. And the alpha monkey totally dominates and controls all the other males. So you see a picture, there's the alpha monkey, and he's like king of the roost, and he's got half the cage to himself. And all the other males are all like hovered over in the corner along with the females. And then what they do is they put an electrode in his brain, and they put a bar inside the cage. And if you stimulate the electrode, either remotely, the scientist does it, or you press the lever, the guy just becomes totally passive and immobilized. So next thing you know, the non-alpha monkeys figure this out. They start cranking on that lever, and you see a picture of the alpha man sitting there like tranced out in the corner, and all the other monkeys are just running riot in the whole cage. And then when he did that with cats, he was able to control where they walked and so on. And he called them in one of his papers mechanical toys. And then you graduate to the work with humans, which is the team at Harvard doing similar work to what Delgado did. And they both describe kids as young as 11. This is what's published, not what's hidden. Kids as young as 11-year-old having electrodes put in their brains for no therapeutic purpose that makes any sense whatsoever. And then you see a picture of a 16-year-old girl. She's just sitting there with a vacant look on her face and like almost drooling. Or she's pounding on the wall furiously. Or she's strumming on her guitar. Or she just looks normal. Depending on which button he's pushing on the remote transmitter box to activate which electrode in her brain. And the 11-year-old boy, when they stimulated one of the electrodes, he started saying that he thought he was a girl and he wanted to marry Jose Delgado. But when they didn't stimulate that electrode, he was just a regular 11-year-old boy. So this is what they actually did, for sure. And there's photographs. And that's what they admit to, and that's what's in the public domain. So you imagine what the classified stuff looks like. And the Harvard team, William Sweet was the surgeon, and one of the Harvard team members went over and worked for Jolly West in the UCLA Violence Project. But while he was at Harvard, he worked with this William Sweet guy, who was the neurosurgeon. At the Clinton hearings related to, there's a report came out in 96 or so, which was the Radiation Experiment Advisory Committee. And the Radiation Experiment Advisory Committee also looked at chemical biological warfare, and there's a bunch of MKUltra-related testimony there too. But in the radiation side of things, William Sweet says that he did in fact participate in experiments at Harvard injecting plutonium into human volunteers, but they all gave informed consent. However, one of the subjects that William Sweet injected with plutonium was HP7. HP stands for human product. So human product 7 was the seventh guy in the series. He came into the emergency department at one of the UMass hospitals, unconscious from a head injury, was injected with plutonium, and died without waking up and without being identified. So it would be a little tricky for him to have given informed consent. So it's just the most insane ethical violations. Another guy, a black guy whose name I forget, was injected with plutonium and was just told, you know, it's part of this research we're doing on your leg. And he was, years later, found out that he'd been injected with plutonium and was actually compensated by the government. So if you're willing to inject somebody with plutonium, I mean, there's no limit to what you're willing to do, right?
Well, that's for sure. And, you know, here's probably a good segue where we can go into, say, the Tuskegee syphilis experiments, or even, you know, I know, and I've, for years, and it's on the SWR archives on the Gnostic Media website, one of the talks on there is Dave Emery discussing about how the U.S. government ran a barge through the San Francisco Harbor for a week and basically got a whole bunch of people sick up there. On top of that, they did the Port Chicago nuclear blast experiment up in the Bay Area in the 1940s, and they put a bunch of black ammunitions officers on the ship and told them to go load this boat, and then they blew this atomic bomb off, and then they, you know, and there's even, you know, obviously somebody had cameras set across the bay filming the whole thing and everything, and then the newspapers reported that the munitions officers had accidentally dropped one of these munitions, and that's how it somehow created a damn mushroom cloud, right?
Yeah, that could often happen if you drop a bullet on the deck. So, right. So sometimes the cover stories are so absurd, right? You wonder how anybody gets fooled with them. But yeah, there was a whole host of radiation experiments. There was, I think it might have been Operation Green Run. It's in my book anyway. The more radiation was released over Spokane to study wind dispersal than was released in the Three Mile Island disaster. So these are the known facts. Again, that's just the tip of the iceberg. Imagine the classified facts that we don't know. And the infectious agent in San Francisco was a oddball bacteria called Serratia marcescens, which I barely heard of in medical school. Nobody ever, ever, ever sees a case. It's extremely rare. But I have a paper published in a medical journal of like 32 or 35 cases of Serratia marcescens infection in the San Francisco area within a period of months, immediately after that bacteria was released by the CIA and biological warfare research. All of that totally documented. So that there's, it's absolutely locked down, documented fact that unwitting civilians have been subjected to radiation, bacteria, plutonium, fungi, LSD, all of that is proven fact. There's a school called the Fernald School in I think again Connecticut, but in the Northeast somewhere, where the parents were told that it's a school for mentally retarded children, basically. The parents are told that there's a study of dietary aspects of mental retardation being conducted. And so they consented. They were actually having plutonium put in their cereal. I mean, it's not just failure of informed consent, it's outright lying. And there's another paper I have in my files, which is mentioned in the book, is funded by the Department of the Army, where they're giving kids infections with infectious agents without their knowledge or consent. And then there's a series of letters to the editor back and forth where doctors are debating whether this is ethical or not ethical, okay or not okay. It's astounding.
Never mind the Hippocratic Oath.
No, no.
Now, what do you think about the operations at Abu Ghraib and Guantanamo Bay?
Well, the first thing I think about that is, well, I'm not surprised that's going on. And there was a Seymour Hersh article that came out about that where he named, I think there was two operational cryptonyms for those programs. So there are actually operations with assigned cryptonyms. And it's in the introduction of my book. I can't remember what the names were now. But so the public thing is these photographs leaked out. Okay, so hold on a second here. Here's the story. So we've got about as secure space as you can possibly have, completely locked down and controlled by the U.S. military and intelligence agencies. So it's very, very secure space. And somebody, some just like hack guys, decide they're going to bring cameras in. And then they set all these poses up, just playing pranks because they decide, oh, you know, we're going to do this. Okay, so where did they get the hoods from? Where did they get the equipment to put on the person's hand to electrically shock them? So all of that stuff, it doesn't just, you know, drop out of the sky into Abu Ghraib prison. There's got to be a requisition for it. It has to be purchased. It has to be shipped. It has to be warehoused. It has to be put on a shelf. It has to be requisitioned. It has to be taken out of storage. It's got to be walked down here. And so we're supposed to believe that our intelligence agencies and military are so pathetic that you can walk in there with a camera, take some pictures, and then there you are in the Middle East, and you take them over to the local Walmart, get them developed, and then leak them to the public. I mean, how is all of this? Just how did the logistics work? It doesn't make any sense logistically.
Well, don't the intelligence establishment, don't they always present the image to the public that they're stupid or incompetent as another smoke screen so that people don't pay attention to what they're doing?
Well, yeah. But if they are that stupid and incompetent, we're in serious trouble, and I don't believe for a second they are that stupid and incompetent. So it's just the whole idea that some low-level people, you know, were partying and did some crazy stuff and were out of control. And the most outrageous part of it is then the guys who are like way down the hierarchy or just following orders are the ones who get burned. How outrageous a way is that to treat your troops? And the public just kind of buys this impossible story. But so it's clearly a well-organized, manualized, mind-controlled, enhanced interrogation programming that goes back through a series of manuals and culture. No doubt about it.
Back to the School of the Assassins and all of that type of stuff. Have you gotten into that? Yeah.
A little bit. I mean, I'm aware of it. I haven't researched it.
I think now they changed it to the School of the Americas. What about Robert Heath? What can you tell us about him?
MD psychiatrist at Tulane University. Funded by all the branches of the military and the CIA. And one of the most interesting things about him is he's connected to Texas Research Institute of Mental Sciences in Houston, where a guy named Birch did brain electrode stuff. And it's just the regular MK Ultra, regular Army contracting with Heath. But with Birch, his colleague and co-author over in Houston, which is not far from New Orleans, there's a list of funding sources, which includes various branches of the military, but it says the CIA for some of the projects. It says what the projects are about, but the designators are XG. So it's some totally different set of, you know, projects under a different cryptonym, which is still classified that we don't know anything about, that the CIA just said they had no information on when I asked them. So there's definitely a whole another set of projects that are still
completely hidden. consider the idea that this, what we've been covering for the last three episodes, that this is what the CIA is and what they do, what their purpose is?
I don't quite understand your question.
Well, I mean, all of these mind control operations, all of this type of stuff, running all of these covert, hidden, secret, you know, these are all things about the occult and tricking people and fooling people and, you know, these types of experiments and things. You know, the more I look at all of these different operations and studies and programs that have been going on for the last, well, since 49 or whenever they were created, it seems like this is really what their purpose is.
Well, what's the alternative? What other purpose could they possibly have? I mean, they're an intelligence agency. Their whole goal is to deceive, trick, and not get deceived and tricked by the opposition.
Well, yeah, but I mean, the issue is it's as much or more being done on the American public than
right.
You know.
So
and the thing is when is the occult ever not used against anyone who doesn't have that information? So it doesn't matter if you're an American citizen or a foreign country, whatever information the CIA has that they keep occulted or secret, you know, they can use against anybody else who doesn't have that information. That's why you occult it. So, I mean, they could very well just as use all of that top secret stuff against us as the next person anywhere else in the world.
Right. So that's where you get labeled loony conspiracy theorist. But there's actually substantial, I mean, it's so big and it's so detailed, it's so interconnected that it's almost invisible because it's so clearly in plain sight.
Well, that's what we have the
it's a difficult thesis to argue.
We have that large database that actually does, you know, put together a whole picture of all
right.
of this stuff, and it really links things together. But let's see. Do you have any other key?
Well, on Robert Heath, I mean, the most insane thing that he did was it's published in the Journal of Nervous and Mental Disease, which is a journal I published in myself, and it's curing homosexuality. So, in the first DSM came out in 1952, and then there was DSM-2, then DSM-3 came out in 1980. And I started my psychiatry training in 1981, so I'm in the DSM-3 era, which is the diagnostic manual. This is back in the late 60s to early 70s, and there, homosexuality is by definition a mental disorder. And this is the official position in the American Psychiatric Association. In the 1980 edition, it wasn't automatically a mental disorder. It was a mental disorder if you had conflict about it. But try being gay in a homophobic society and not having any conflict about it. And then in the DSM-4 in 1994, it was like further removed. So there was homosexuality was a mental disorder. Then there was ego dystonic homosexuality was a mental disorder. And then ego dystonic homosexuality disappeared. And under sexual disorder not otherwise specified, one subtype was people who were gay and had conflicts about it. So it didn't actually get totally removed. It got downplayed and kind of put back in the back. But back in the late 60s, early 70s, it was a disorder. So the psychiatrist wanted to cure it. So, and this is in the published paper. There's all mainstream declassified literature. There's this 19-year-old gay guy who's brought in. They put brain electrodes in his head, and they target center of the brain that's got to do with arousal. And so then they have either ability to stimulate remotely, or they have a wire going from the electrode out to a little gizmo that's actually on your belt. And the guy could push the button himself and put himself in a pre-orgasmic state. But they had to take the gizmo away from him because he pushed it 1,500 times in 3 hours. So what they did, though, is they stimulated his brain electrically to get him in this pre-orgasmic state and then had him watch heterosexual pornography for many hours. And then to see whether the conditioning had worked, they brought in a female prostitute. This is all described in the paper. And they went in another room they had sex while they're monitoring his brainwaves. Then they come out and they debrief the prostitute about how it went. Did he seem to enjoy it? Did he have an orgasm? And she said, yeah. And then he was discharged, successfully cured of homosexuality with only one relapse in the first 9 months. So this is, if you said, you know, a patient came and told me this is what happened to me at Tulane 34 years ago, guaranteed 100% false memories. But there it is, published in the mainstream literature. And again, that's just what got published. So you're just trying to remake people with whatever technology you can. And there's, as you're well aware, there's the kind of one person at a time, but you can't. Like, how would you even finance putting an electrode in everybody's brain? It's just too cumbersome and too big and too complicated. Except now we get more and more nanotechnology and more satellites, it becomes more and more actually feasible. But clearly these more reaching the whole population with a broad program is the way to go. And you only need to control the individual person if you want to use them for a specific like individual task. That's how it looks to me.
Are there any other topics that you think are important that we should include in this before we wrap it up?
Non-lethal weapons, which we might have touched on briefly before. But so I get quite a few emails and communications who are having electromagnetic energy beamed at them to control them. And, I think we did go over this in one of the previous hours.
Yeah, we talked about it briefly, but go ahead.
So these are people who are easily blown off as nutcases. But if you look at the actual declassified existing technology, going all the way back to the 50s, there was a sound energy and electromagnetic weapons energy being beamed at experimental animals and human beings described in the MKUltra documents. And so what's happened since then? Obviously, it's got miniaturized, it's become wireless, it's computerized, it's probably up in the satellite or somewhere, or it's up in the cell tower or wherever. So there's all this technology that exists now to implement all of this that didn't exist in the MKUltra era. So that was like Edison first light bulb back then. And so given the history of all of this testing on unwitting civilians, what are the odds that civilians have never been tested with non-lethal weapons? Virtually zero, I would say. So therefore, when people make these claims, it's perfectly plausible that some of them are describing what's actually going on. Others may be delusional. So it's not like my colleagues are listening, but if I had the ear of all my colleagues, I would say, as a psychiatrist, you cannot scientifically, based on the evidence, take the position that you automatically know for sure that all these people are delusional. There's going to be somebody in there who's not delusional. Or maybe part of their story is delusional, but there's a kernel of truth. And there's going to be some people just aren't delusional. They're just describing what's going on. To me, that's a very minimum, it's a very realistic possibility.
Dr. Colin Ross, what is the single most important idea that you would like people to take away from our third interview?
It's the same basic idea all the time, which is completely consistent with what you've been saying about logic and rhetoric and so on, which is you've got to evaluate things rationally and critically and not just buy what you're being sold at school, at church, on CNN, when Obama's talking, doesn't matter what the source of the information is. And a lot of these fantastic conspiracy theories can have some truth to them, or a lot of truth.
Would you like to give out your website and any book titles that you think are most important for people to read and study and that sort of thing?
Well, that depends which segment of the brain of Colin Ross you're looking at. On CIA military mind control, it's the CIA doctors, and there's a case history called military mind control. So then how to do therapy with highly traumatized people, there's a series of books about that. And then I have more philosophical, anthropological type books. And then I've got my human energy fields theory, which the book is called Human Energy Fields. So there's a lot of kind of things to dip into there. So the website address is short for the Ross Institute, www.rossinst.com. Or you can just search under Dr. Colin Ross or under the Ross Institute. And then you'll get to the website, and then there's a bookstore that has all my books. Or you can find pretty well all the books on Amazon, including some in Kindle version.
Great. Dr. Colin Ross, thank you so much for this. What has it been now? For more than 4.5 hours that we've done here. So it's a great series, and I think it'll get a lot of exposure and bring a lot of attention to the issue.
Thanks for the opportunity, and congratulations on all your work.
Likewise, and thank you. All right, Colin, take care.
Okay.